You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to the brilliant Trygve Wakenshaw. Now, I must apologise for my hungover state. This was at the very end of the Edinburgh Festival just passed. This is the last of the Edinburgh Festival recordings I made, and you can very much tell it's the end of the festival. So sorry about the quality of my voice, and I don't think the quality of the interview suffers. In fact, who knows? Let me know, tweet me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com if you think I'm better when I'm hungover, and together we can stamp out this sober Stuart Goldsmith menace. I think it worked out in the end. This is the brilliant Trygve Wakenshaw.
I did a gig in New Zealand that was, it was these kind of comedy award things. And it was being filmed, and so all the like house lights were up more than usual. And backstage, all the comics were just going like, "Oh my god, I can see all the audience. It's really tough." I'm like, "What are you guys talking about? You have to see the audience, right?" They're like, "No. I like it when it's just lights in my eyes, and it's like I'm performing to a big black void."
That's weird, isn't it?
It's so weird. And yes. It's like, but then how do you? So you just stand there with your eyes closed and talk. And hope laughter happens, rather than going like, "Hey, we're in a funny time."
There's definitely a sensitive two-way process, even when you can't see them, and maybe it's heightened because you're listening to their reactions. Maybe, but it does seem to me to speak more from the stand-ups I know who like to work like that. I think it's motivated more by them saying, "I don't want to see them," and I wonder. I suppose my instinct is that is born of tough gigs. Wankers in the audience, people, you know, what you don't want to see is someone bored looking at their shoes when you're hitting your stride and you're rocking 90% of the room. And you can't help but focus on that one person that's picking their teeth or rolling their eyes or whatever.
Yeah.
And I suppose if you eliminate the audience, then it stops that from happening. So how do you feel about working in front of an audience when people aren't going for it? Are you happy
I can understand being thrown by that one guy. Like, I get a little bit thrown by that one guy who's just not happy. But I quite like playing the game of like, "Okay, buddy, this show is for you. And forget about the other 90% that are having a nice time, because you've won them. You just want to work on this, like, horrible guy who's sitting there with a frown on his face, not enjoying you." And it's so satisfying when you win and you turn them and you see them like kind of give up and be like, "Okay, funny guy."
Yeah.
It's so satisfying.
But you can't always win.
No, you can't always win, but you try really hard.
And when you don't win, how do you feel about that? How is that? What's the emotional thing of like giving your all? And your all in your case is sweat and nudity, and it's a lot, you know. But you've just given it everything you can, and you've focused on that one person. And if it doesn't work, do you get in a like? Do you ever find yourself getting angry with them, or? Do you resent them, or do you feel sorry for them because you're the sort of lovely archetypal clown guy and they didn't find the love today? What is it?
I don't know. No, I think I just, you know, you let them win. You go, like, if you've worked really hard to beat them and they still have nothing, you're like, "Well, okay, you won this round, buddy, but I'll come back."
Optimism.
Yeah. And then I get, because then at that point you've probably started losing the rest of the 90% that were into you, and you're like, "Okay, sorry, buddy, I got to go back to the rest of the crowd now."
Yeah,
So tell us, for people who haven't seen you, tell us what it is that you do.
I don't know. I think it's, I describe it best as just me being alone on stage for an hour showing off. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much it. I start, like, with the shows, I started trying to follow a stream of consciousness rather than a narrative. So from one, like, physical pose, it might inspire me to start becoming a crocodile or something. So none of the scenes really need an end, because they just sort of morph into the next thing.
Okay, so what? Sense? So we'll try and zero in on it, because obviously a lot of people listening to will know who you are and what you do. You've had a fantastic year this year at the Fringe.
A really great year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I saw your show Squid Boy last year in Melbourne, and I saw Kraken this year, and Kraken was nominated.
Yeah, we got a Barry and a Golden Gibbo nomination in Australia. Won the Fred Award in New Zealand. And then I got a runner-up for an Amused Moose.
Did you?
Award,
you got a runner-up for the Amused Moose.
I was beaten by Celia Piccola and Chris Turner.
Friend of the show. Brilliant.
Yeah, lovely. She's great.
Great.
So it's great. They're great.
But what is it? When you say scenes, we're not talking about stand-up here. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what does it look like?
So it's kind of, it's, what does it look like? It's a bit mime. I'm okay with saying mime. Some people go like, ugh, mime, don't say mime. Because it's sort of different, because I kind of talk a little bit as well. So, to answer the question, what is the thing I'm doing? I am kind of sort of miming physical body dressed in lycra, sweaty, pretend imagination world creating land.
Beautiful.
Joy.
We'll listen back to that and we'll make an acronym. I'm a gefafwasowal, or whatever it is. You didn't use the word clown at any point there. Do you? Would you think of yourself as a clown, or is that what does that mean?
I think it's too. It's a really difficult word, like what producer is. You know, like it's one of these things that is so broad it doesn't really identify anything very well, and. And people will only have a sort of specific example. Like, from the general public, if you say clown, then they get an idea of a red nose and floppy shoes and circus stuff. Maybe you go like, oh, no, but like a more theatrical clown. And so it becomes like Cirque du Soleil kind of vibe. But then you've got all these hipster clowns that are kind of cool new kids just trying out really weird shit on stage.
Who are that? Who, I don't know who you mean by that. Who's that genre? Can you name any examples?
Yeah, I'd say like the crew that do Le Flop, that sort of gang.
I've never seen that. Okay.
There's a thing called Cardboard Cabaret, which was in London. I'm not sure if that's still happening. Maybe like what's his name? Doonal? Doonan? Daniel. Doonam? Dum Dum.
I don't know who you mean.
Ding dong. I don't know any of their names. I'm really bad with names.
Describe then the difference between your work and theirs, if they're kind of hipster clowns. What do they do that you wouldn't do, or vice versa? Just because that's interesting to me. I feel like I know quite a lot about clowning and contemporary stuff, but I've no idea what you mean. So,
What do I mean? Hipster clowns. I think I mean basically anyone that's new into exploring the stuff of how to be a clown on stage, maybe in a stand-up context or in a theatrical context.
Okay.
The kind of idea of starting with a game and doing and finding scenes within that.
Okay.
I think that's the one where falls into this like really broad spectrum of like, so you've got traditional circus clown, Cirque du Soleil clown, and then this clown, which is sort of being funny but not being a stand-up comedian.
Okay. And you wouldn't,
not being a character.
And you wouldn't
sketch.
Call yourself one of them, because you... What criteria do you fulfil that sets you apart from that?
I just don't...
That was a really boring scientific way to talk about the joyful, world-creating, imagination, silly stuff that you do. But is it what, that you're not improvising on stage, that
I do a lot of improvising on stage. I don't know. Maybe I'm just like I have a mild allergy to the word clown at the moment.
Yeah.
And so I don't consider myself one. Because they don't really know exactly what I am. Like, sometimes I feel like I'm a bit actor, sometimes a little bit comic, physical mime guy.
Do you find that that is a help or a hindrance to have such a kind of nebulous definition of what you do? Like, to me, I can say to people, I'm a stand-up comic. And my dad, I remember, was very happy when I became a stand-up because he could finally explain what I did to people.
Yeah, right.
Because I did lots of nebulous, weird, performy, comedy-ish, street-y things for a long time. And he was like, oh, you're a stand-up comic. I know what that is. Yeah. Is it useful to you in some ways that what you do is nebulous? Is it?
It's useful to me in thinking about what I do. But then, yeah, when you're like describing it to family and relations, like, what do you do? Sometimes they'll say, so I think I usually just say performer.
Yeah,
and
then
it's this like lovely coverall, like could be an actor, musician. Sure. We just don't know. We don't talk about it.
So in Kraken, let's focus on Kraken. Okay. So that was the one that's, you know, that's your latest piece of work. Is that, have you got anything else that you're, we'll get to next stuff next.
Future things.
Sorry, for the benefit of the listener, hello you. I'm terrifically hungover. It's the last Monday of the Fringe. It's Dirty Monday, which no one should work. Mm. And Trigby's doing a show later on, so we're very pleased to have him here. So I was going to ask, yes. So again, just to describe it for people who have never seen anything like it, an example of one of the scenes that you do in Kraken would be what, when you're the one that blew me away was the snake, and I'll get obviously the audience singing the music. I just thought that was lovely when you catch on what's going on.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. There's other things I want to talk about that. But just pick one of your bits. Just describe what one of your scenes.
Like crowd pleaser, the one that I can pull out at parties and variety nights really easy is the baby bird.
The baby bird. Okay.
Sequence.
Yes. Describe the baby bird sequence to us.
Okay, so step by step. So what you do, should I do it like a how to do the baby bird?
Please, that would be lovely.
So step by step. Step one, stand in the middle of a dark stage, a lit stage, but make sure there's nothing around. Cross your eyes slightly and look like a happy, confused, innocent, slightly cross-eyed, daft bird of happiness. And smile and experiment with your voice by going, and then flap your little wings, if you can hear that. And continue to look daft and confused and really happy and joyous, like you're new and the world is a delightful place. Then what you want to do, you want to ride that wave until the audience are bored of looking at a daft bird. And then you introduce a new character into the game. And this is a big, eagerly, flappy, full wingspan, eyes that furrow like when you're a bad guy and you draw eyebrows on things to make them look angry, like that. So you're a bird, you're flying towards the baby bird, dun dun dun, what's gonna happen, no one knows. Then the baby bird, oh no, big bad bird's coming towards you, it's gonna land. It lands on the side of the nest, and then the baby bird looks up. And then back to the big bird who's standing there and starts slowly trying to regurgitate some food from the deepest part of his gut up towards his throat. But knows it can't quite make the vomit yet. Baby bird's still in anticipation, waiting, what's going to happen? Big bird sticks two fingers down his throat, starts vomiting profusely down into the mouth of the baby bird.
And let's just interject at this point. If you, the listener, are feeling disgusted by this, this is what happens in nature. This is a natural process.
Yeah, I'm a documentarian, really. I should describe myself as that. I'm not a clown, I'm more a documentarian. So where are we? The large bird is vomiting into the mouth of the baby bird. Baby bird really happy. Devouring, yum, vomit, yum, 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 yum. The big bird, more vomits. Eating, eating, oh, I'm getting full. signal, no, thank you, that's quite enough, I've had enough, thank you. But the big bird can't stop vomiting. It's just... Except then the vomiting gets more, and then the big eagle bird needs to do a shit, so he pulls down his pants and shits all over the baby bird, and then continues to vomit on the baby bird, and then vomits some more as the baby bird starts drowning in this small puddle of sick that's in the nest that he's sitting in. And then the eagle, big mama dad bird, starts pissing on the little baby bird, and then continues vomiting on the baby bird, and the baby bird drowns or doesn't, and then the big bird finishes vomiting, cleans his mouth, and flies away to interact in a different world.
You paint, I mean, I was expecting a far less vivid picture of that. I mean, it's great. You can see the extent to which your enthusiasm for this disgusting scene you've created just shines and bubbles through that description. So, I mean, and I saw this a couple of nights ago, and people were crying laughing at this.
There was one night where someone in the front row, I could see out of the corner of my eye, they were in the front row, and they just, like, fell off their chair.
Oh.
Like, a genuine... Ruffle.
Fowler. Oh my God, a genuine.
It was a genuine ruffle. And it was so, I nearly stopped and just laughed at them.
And the whole of your hour, of the hour that is Kraken, is it the same hour every time? Is it the same scenes in the same order?
More or less. At the start of this run, there was a scene which was called The Archer, where I'd be a bad archer trying to shoot apples off people's heads. And it was okay. I could just never find the nice rhythm of it. So that one ended up disappearing.
Okay.
It was a good scene.
The other scenes include, briefly, things like...
The boxer?
The boxer, yes. Tell me the game of the boxer. Remember what game
you're playing? Boxer is just like shadow boxing, except then you start hitting yourself.
Yeah.
And then just kind of building up that you're fighting this invisible psycho shadow guy who's just out to maim you.
And you've also got cutting a hole in your stomach and eating, like, you get a unicorn's horn from a member of the audience, you saw the horn off, you do sword swallowing with the horn, and then it pokes a hole in your stomach, and then you've got, for the rest of the show, anytime you eat something, it falls out of the hole in your stomach. So all of these things, this incredible sort of cornucopia of frequently savage, visceral... shit and vomit and piss and blood, kind of frequently.
I've got a bad case of like animal cruelty equals comedy.
Yeah,
it happens all the time. And I've just recently become vegan to impress a really beautiful girl, and now I'm having like issues. I'm like. Yeah, I can't condone all this animal cruelty that I'm doing in my show. So now if I make another show, I've got to find something else that is funny, not just hurting animals.
Do you think it's is it equivalent to a stand-up comic being fixated with dick jokes?
Yeah, maybe. It's a little bit where you get a laugh. You know it gets a laugh.
Is it immature?
It's really, yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't mean immature in a childish way. I mean, like, for you as a world mime guy, mime imaginary world engineer, is it, and I suppose it's sort of arguably a bit of a challenging question, but is it, do you sort of think, okay, in 10 years' time, I'll be able to do a show that doesn't need, that is as funny without needing any animal cruelty, murder, shit, piss, all the rest of it?
Yeah, definitely. It does feel, like, as far as material's concerned, it feels like, it's great. I love it. It's funny and stupid. It makes me giggle still. But it is a little bit cheap. I kind of go, like, yeah. I know people.
I didn't think that at all at the time.
Here's a cute bunny rabbit,
yeah.
And they paint this picture of this bunny rabbit for you, you're like, oh. I know that if I then go, like, snap its neck, everyone's going to go, oh, my God, oh, why? And there's this, like, it's a funny laugh, but... I know it works. It's easy.
So which parts of the show are the most challenging for you? The show as it exists at the moment. Is any of it challenging in the moment? Do you Is there any fear? Is there any not knowing what's going to happen next? Or is it that this is a script now and you know what the games are and you always have an end to everything and it...
It's becoming more of a script. I'm trying to... Sometimes I'll just do a show where I'm like, okay, I'm not going to do any of those scenes. I need about another 15 minutes of material that I don't know what is.
So you'll do 15 of new improvising in the middle of an hour?
Yeah, just because... Otherwise, because I start getting... That's the hardest bit, is going, like, keeping all the stuff that I know really fresh. I mean, that's sort of the beauty of this show, is that I can lose scenes like The Archer if I go, like, ah, I don't know. And it could come back one day. Like, sometimes they come back in, sometimes they throw them away forever.
Mm.
Like, there used to be a mime hula hoop act that I do. But, yeah, just a little bit, like, kind of come and go. And for my own, like, especially at this festival, like, you just need... Because the pressure of, like, everyone coming in going, okay, funny man, let's see you be funny. Everyone's been talking about it. And that pressure of, like, that judgment and expectation and stuff, sometimes it's too much and you just need to go, I'm just going to try out some shit. I need to do this for me.
Okay.
You know?
Are you able to do that at shows where you've got, inverted commas, someone important in? If you've got, like, you know, industry, like a festival director or something, would you improvise under those circumstances? Or do you, more like a comedian, do you go, I'm going to do the old gold here?
I'd probably stick to old gold unless I was feeling, like, particularly snappy and frisky. And then I'd happily, like, I don't mind if, like, a festival judge or something is in, if I'm feeling playful and cool.
Mm.
But sometimes that, like, knowing that there's a bunch of important people there makes it really hard to go into that special place of, like, zing, 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 zing.
That's definitely...
Because you're always judging yourself.
Yeah.
Going like, I just want to be good. I just want to be good.
Yeah. But
there is no such thing.
And what is it? What is the state that you like to be in then, as opposed to the just wanting to be good? You just want to what? If it's a show and you're flowing... Is there anything that you want, or is it just describe that sort of state of mind?
It's just a playfulness. There's sort of two parts of it. There's the sort of real present tense, like, just playfulness, being really hyper-aware of everything that's happening with my body or whatever, and getting inspiration from that. But then there's also, like, when you can do the two levels, and the second level being... that one that has the eye over the whole show. And so you're remembering where you put down an invisible stick earlier on. You remember where, what page you were at in an invisible book, and you can, like, call back to that stuff and reference it and somehow tie it all together. That's when it's, like, an amazing show. When you've been, like, improvising all this stuff and you find new connections all through it. I love that.
Lovely man, Trigvi. One of those people you could just hate because he's so brilliant, and then you meet him and fuck everything if he isn't lovely as well. Ugh. Really interesting conversation with him. Some great stuff here. You've heard about his honesty, I think, about dealing with difficult audience members as well. And he's such a bastard, he even recognises his faults. Disgusting. So lots more good stuff to come on there, including why I'm scared of Goliath. So that's all coming up. Some interesting clown stuff on this one. Well done if you're a stand-up and you've listened this far and not simply eschewed it and gone, oh, it's clown stuff, I don't care about that, clowns are weird. Because I think there's a lot to learn that we can all get our teeth into. A couple of replies to the issue of releasing one's stuff online. I got an email from Mark Jones, who said nice things about the show. Thank you, Mark. He goes on to say, I just thought I'd respond to your question about comedians releasing sets on Bandcamp. As someone with limited resources who doesn't live near any comedy venues, I would love it if acts of the kind you interview put shows or albums on Bandcamp and would happily pay to download them. Now, thank you, Mark, for that, and it's a good point. But I've got to admit, you do need a distribution network for that to work. You need to make people aware that the product is there. That's why the circuit's so frustrating, isn't it? Because so many people are capable of doing the job, but how do you get a following who are going to seek out your stuff? It's like if you treat Bandcamp like YouTube. You put stuff out, doesn't mean anyone's going to look at it or download it. If you have any answers on a postcard to info@comedianscomedian.com, especially if you've released stuff on Bandcamp before, either as a comic or a musician. No, I don't care about musicians. Tell me if you're a comic. How was that experience? Did people buy it? Let me know.
Just time to thank the latest lot of donators. Thank you, all of you. Rachel Reardon says her favourites were Acaster and Tom Stade. Thank you, Rachel, for your donation and for your kind comments. Thank you as well to Michael Hollingworth, Vanessa Hammock, very kind of you. Thank you to everyone that's donated. You too can join the tidal wave of people who are keen to support the show. Just go to comedianscomedian.com and click on the PayPal button. All of your money goes towards making the show in better, buying making the show better, that's like improved and better at the same time, buying new and better equipment, paying the people upon whose help I rely, and also helping me plan and activate ways to make the show bigger and more vast and expansive. I've got some really big ideas coming up. I know I keep saying that without telling you, but you'll see. You'll all see. So thank you to all of those. Plus, if you donate, I might have a couple of drinks. How would that be? £5, £10, or £20 is more than welcome. And if you want to go crazy with a pound a show, please be my guest. Comedianscomedian.com. Guest news now. I had a great conversation with David Cross, which I will be releasing next week. He's given me a thing that I hope I can make available, an alternate ending to one of his albums, which Sub Pop didn't let him put out, but which he's given to me and said, hey, put it out there. I just need to double and triple check that he actually can legally let me release it and that I'm not going to get in trouble. SoundCloud have already been in touch to say, hey, we recognise this, it's not yours. So hopefully that'll be with you soon. Certainly the interview will be. We recorded that live in the top room of a pub, the Nell Gwynn in Soho, who very kindly let us in there after a bit of a last-minute space crisis. So really interesting conversation with David. I don't know if I'll release that as two episodes or one big long one or one edited one. I'll just have to see. Now, it's back to Trigvy. Where do you come from as a performer? How did you start doing this? What were you like as a... Were you a funny kid?
I was a playful kid that enjoyed, like, I liked doing drama and acting and showing off.
And where, what sort of circumstance, what kind of town did you grow up in?
It was in New Zealand. It was a town called Havelock North. And it was, I don't know, it was kind of smallish town, but... I mean, New Zealand's all very small. It's a smallish town, not like a little country hick town, but a smallish town. The school that I went to had a very strong... It's sort of... There were two quite distinct groups. There was the, like, sports kids, but then also quite a strong artistic kids side as well. Mm-hmm. So lots of sort of artists, musicians, and the group of friends that I was in that were really into... performance and
were you dancing. Sporty as well?
No, I was never no. sporty.
You that must have infuriated the sports teachers because you look like a natural.
I do
athlete,
now, but you know. I do now because I'm really good looking and fit and strong.
Yeah,
I've developed into a good looking guy. Whereas at high school, like I was just this weird lanky, white, brittle idiot.
Okay.
Now I'm all cool looking.
It's cool, funny, man. I mean, you have an incredible physicality. When you're being the eagle, your wingspan is enormous. I mean, it's just joyous to watch. I was having a conversation with my girlfriend earlier today about the fact, I think she Facebooked after we went to see the show. She put a status saying something along the lines of, great, Stu just took me to see an incredibly funny, naked, sexy, athletic clown guy. And I'm like, yeah, Stu does not like this. But we were having a conversation earlier on today about whether or not it is, whether you feel risky or vulnerable getting your dick out at the beginning of the show, given that you're a big, handsome guy. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if, like, I feel like a lot of people, were they to get naked on stage, that's like, oh, I'm letting you in, this is vulnerable, this is sort of awful. But you are kind of like Adonis-like, and kind of, you know, you're like a ballet dancer or something. And we just go, do you feel vulnerable at that point? I realised we were talking about your childhood 2 seconds ago. We'll go back to that in a second after the dick questions.
I don't feel weird. Ever since the first time I did it, I was so nervous, like in the anticipation leading up to, oh my God, I'm going to get naked in front of all these people. And then I did it and I was fine. And it was really weird. I just felt very comfortable. I sort of don't mind. I could probably do the whole show naked. It would be distracting, but...
It would be distracting, yeah, yeah, fair enough. Okay, so you weren't sporty.
Although Vicky Stone asked me, okay, along these lines, Vicky Stone, who I was sharing the room with a few days ago, she asked me if I had a very visible case of genital herpes, would I still do
you
that?
You would have a responsibility to your audience to still do it. That would be, if you didn't, that would be like having a joke about a wheelchair, and then if someone was in a wheelchair was in the audience, you didn't do the joke. Unacceptable.
Yeah. You know, I'll just avoid visible genital herpes.
Do your best. So you're a playful kid. You're doing more like theatre sports, acting kind of stuff?
Yeah, I did lots of theatre sports at school and acting. I think the year that I went through was the first year that the school had a drama class for each of the years. Like, before it would have been, like, third and fourth form. I don't know if you have that.
I never know what we call it in Britain. I did a different system.
So, like, when I was 13 and 14, there were classes, and then I think in previous years when you're 15, 16, 17, that class no longer existed, but then the year that I went through, that was there all the time. So I was really focused on doing drama and stuff all through school, and then I left. And the school that I was at as well, they also every year had this National Youth Drama School, so like kids from all over New Zealand would come to my school and would spend 2 weeks in this kind of like acting camp, kind of, I think it was a week or 2 weeks, maybe 1 week. And so you do like different classes, kind of like specialized classes, like stand up comedy or clown.
God,
or
New Zealand, brilliant. This sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. And of course, everyone's like between the ages of sort of 15 to 17. So everyone's like just found their gang, their like tribe of other people that like doing acting with them. And everyone's like crying at the end of this week because they've made such good friends. It was a beautiful, beautiful times.
Idyllic. It sounds lovely.
Yeah.
And what were you getting out of that stuff? Community? Were you
a little bit community?
Artistically also, excited, expressing yourself? What was?
Yeah, and I was a real show off as well. So I kind of became, and because I was there for sort of 3 or 4 years in a row, I became a popular figure at the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was suddenly from being like in school, like a guy that people know, but he's a bit of a drama freak, weirdo kid, to like suddenly like this accepted and popular and super cool guy that everyone was like, oh man, that trivia, he's so funny, he blows my mind. I think that was part of it that like kept me in the game, you know.
And just
it's like a support thing. Like you've got a support of all these like other people that like you. My parents were always really supportive of me doing acting.
Really? No, I didn't mean really. I mean that was the beginning of a different sentence. Really, given that you had such a supportive background, following the narrative structure of what makes a comedian, you should be like a really bland, uninteresting guy with nothing to say because you've come from a crucible of support and people thinking you are cool and all the rest of it. Do you know what I mean? Normally you think, comedians, people who have the flaw in their heart or mind of what makes them pursue comedy in some way, normally that's the result of
torture.
Difficulty. Yeah. Were you a happy kid?
Yeah, I was a really happy kid. I've always been a really happy kid.
Fucking improvisers, man. They just don't know. Improvisers are all happy. Make me sick.
Yeah, and I do think about it. Like, I've come from a real, you know, a fairly privileged background. I've never had that much, like, stress or stuff in my life. Maybe that's why I don't do political, gritty. I don't do anything political and gritty, sort of social commentary. I just kind of try. I enjoy messing around with people's heads and going like, hey, do you guys see this funny world that we're all playing in?
And when did you first think you could turn it into a profession?
I think I always thought it. I tried. So, like, only the last 2 years I've been successful in doing it. And before that, I've spent a long time just trying to make shows and be funny. Like, I kind of come from theatre background.
Okay.
I had a go at stand-up comedy when I was about 20 and didn't like it. I didn't really like the scene very much, and I didn't like writing.
Where were you? Where did you do it? In Auckland?
This was in Auckland, yeah.
Okay. So did you play the classic? Did you ever do
that? Yeah.
Yeah, great. Excellent.
Yeah.
But what was it about the scene that didn't turn you on? Did you find it?
I don't like the thing of, you know, when you're backstage or at a bar or something with a bunch of comics and everyone's being aggressively funny towards each other.
Oh, yeah.
Like trying to out-joke the next guy. And I used to go like, oh, I can't play this game very well and I don't like it. And so I sort of left. I can appreciate it. I'm like, oh, yeah, you guys are just like sharpening your little comedy teeth on each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But it was a game that I never really wanted to play or was good at, so I was like, I'm out.
I was interviewing Steen Raskopoulos, and he said something interesting about one of the principles of improvising, which is to make everyone else on stage look brilliant. That's like one of the rules in a theatre sports kind of way. Make your partner look great, and everyone's trying to do that. And it did occur to me that is the opposite of the stand-up comedy mentality, yeah. Which is often, shut up, everyone, I want to say my thing.
Yeah.
And, maybe that's more to do with that kind of unhappy childhood thing. Maybe that's where that comes from, is stand-up is sort of can be a less giving thing. You know, yeah. Stand-up sometimes feels like you're trying to take something from them, you're trying to get a reaction from them, rather than you're trying to give them an experience.
Yeah, that's true.
That's an enormous brushstroke that I'm painting because I'm talking to a clown mime guy and I'm in a happy mood. There are loads of really giving positive stand-ups as well. And loads of evil clowns. Are there any evil clowns? Red Bastard. I've never seen him. I always clashed with his shows. But is he an evil clown?
I don't know. Sort of. Not really.
It's marketing.
Yeah, I think it's just marketing. He wants to get to you.
He's a provocateur, isn't he?
Right? He's a provocateur. Okay. That's the word.
Okay. So you had a go at some stand-up. Did you write jokes or did you improvise the stand-up that you did?
I wrote jokes. Oh, yeah. So this National Youth Drama School thing, I studied under Benjamin Crallen. Do you know this guy?
I know
guy?
Ben, yeah, yeah.
Who is now the darkest guy. But at the time, he's such a good, like, joke writer. And so he had all this, like, yeah. So I learnt how to write stand-up comedy under him. And then... yeah, so he kind of had some material about roadworks, I think it was. It was really...
The look in your face when you said, oh, I had some roadworks.
My material days. it was fine. It was moderately funny and I was moderately charming delivering it. But I couldn't keep writing. I'm not very good at sitting alone in a room and doing writing and going, ah, this will be funny. They'll like this. I kind of have to do it a bit on stage. I don't know. And it just got a bit limiting. Anyway, I went and turned to theatre for a while after that, and I met my friend Barney Duncan, who was doing a show called Calypso Nights. Not sure if you saw
it. Oh, I haven't seen that one, no.
Really good. Anyway, we got together and had this like shared love of Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, silent film kind of stuff, and then started trying to recreate that on stage a little bit. Had a theatre company, made show after show as like young, broke, enthusiastic little guys in Auckland.
Okay, and putting on shows to who? Did you get audiences? Did you?
Yeah, we'd do audiences. We got audiences. You know how it goes when you're fresh to the thing. It's usually your mates and maybe your parents and a couple of their mates. Like it's not a really big, broad spectrum.
And what sorts of shows were you doing? Like when you. Kind of double act stuff, sketches, cross-talk?
No, we were trying to do like kind of silent comedy, like an hour-long show that... So, yeah, we made a couple with these two characters called Toot and Collins, who are kind of like a Laurel and Hardy sort of duo, like two idiots that can't really function without each other. One's the real sort of straight, always has the plans.
Which were you?
I was that one. Like, really... knows what he's doing, but everything goes wrong for him all the time.
Okay.
And then Toot, which was Barney's character, is like a floppy, loose, happy-go-lucky idiot. So that sort of thing. And we'd write little stories around it. Like, so one of them, we're two builders who have to renovate an old church. An old go-go bar into a church to cover up a murder that has happened there.
Okay.
One is we're two chefs having to... And a magic chicken wanders into the restaurant and we have to save it from the bad guy. when we were two circus performers that had been kicked out of a circus. And we were just, the whole show was us trying to get back into the circus with various acts.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. So we were kind of like Laurel and Hardy, trying to do that kind of vibe.
And did that have a, did you feel that could have been the thing that propelled you to sort of professional performing? Was it good enough? Did it have enough pull?
I don't know. I mean, we're still performing The Magic Chicken, which is the one where we're two chefs. That's sort of going around Australia, and it's billed as like a family show. For me, it's now, it's, I look at it and go, ah, yep, that's what I made in my early 20s. Like, sure. It feels like a show that I made 10 years ago kind of thing.
Yeah,
and it's quite stuck in that time as well. It's hard when you make a theatre show. Like, you kind of go, this is the script and where it is. And now I feel like I've moved on. Like, since then, I've been to Goliere. I've come out, I've made, like, a bunch of different solo shows. When I say a bunch, I mean two.
What propelled you to go to Goliere? What was the inspiration for that move?
It was just boredom of New Zealand.
Okay.
There wasn't enough stuff. I'd sort of worked with all the companies that I wanted to work with in New Zealand, and had been inspired and stolen ideas from all the people I'd wanted to steal ideas from, and it just ran out of people. It's a real New Zealand problem.
Now, all I know about Goliere, I know from talking to Phil Burgers, Dr. Brown, and yes. Other people. I know some other kind of people who are doing that kind of merging clown stand-up sort of stuff. A couple of people in the UK I've spoken to. All I know about working with Goliere is that he is tyrannical and makes everyone cry, and it's the hardest thing anyone's ever done in their life. Was that your experience?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't cry. I think I had a slow build kind of a crisis where I just kind of just got more and more frustrated, but it never went blah in an explosive crying fit. It was just this like frustration of being bad day after day after day after day after day, and eventually something started to crack.
What was that? To tell us about that experience. What is it that
I don't know. Like, you see people on stage sometimes, and you see the moment where they're like, they just get so frustrated that they're doing badly that they just go, "Bah! Oh, I just don't know," and get shouty and cry and like do all this stuff on stage. And at that moment, you see them like just kind of giving up all this pretense that heaps of people have when they go on stage. They have like a acting persona, even if they're...
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Trying to be like, yeah, it's just me. They're still acting me.
Often the them is. Do you think they're acting that? That's an act that they do in their day to day lives.
No, I think it's quite. It's different. Like, you can feel it. I don't know. Do you feel it when you go, when you're off stage? You're just hanging out with people. Da da da. There's little bits that you do.
Oh, it depends on how well I know them. Like, there's people, there's my friends, there's the way I am with my girlfriend is different to the way I am with you, someone I like who I've only met a few times, is different to the way I am with, say, two or three mates in a room, but there's also someone there I don't like.
Yeah,
right. Do you know what I mean? There's lots of different kind of versions of me.
Different levels of you.
I don't know which is most sort of true, but I think the idea of... I mean, I did the Dr. Brown clown course. I did one of his, like, 3 or 4 day courses, and... So I experienced those sorts of exercises there when you're kind of like, come on with nothing.
Yeah.
Now do something.
Yeah.
And I definitely am very cerebrally led and very kind of thought led. That was, I did sort of clowning stuff maybe 10 years ago or more. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably more like 20 now, but 15 or something. But I think I was terrible at it because I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop appraising it and analysing it and going, oh, what is it? And for one little moment during Phil's course, for a sliver of a second, I was just being honestly funny.
Yeah.
And it was thrilling, but surrounded by me just being shit over and over and over again. I don't know if I could cope with that. I don't know if I mentally have enough confidence in myself to go, I'm going to go somewhere and be shit for 6 months.
Yeah.
I think I'd cry. I think it would break me.
But the thing is, like, in all of that, in Goliere, the thing is, like, you have that little taste. So you had that little taste of what this genuine funny moment was like. And this is what I think the Goliere school is like, you get these tastes and you can remember that taste really well. And you never know how you got there, but I'm always like searching for that flavor again, that like delicious thing where you're just like open and everyone's laughing and you don't really know why, but you are loving it.
That's interesting. They're
your
laughing.
Your eyes are just like sparkling.
And you don't know why. Yeah. Now, there are moments in your show when you know why they're laughing. Are there moments in your show where you don't know why they're laughing?
Yeah, sometimes. I tried to make the show based on that, on like an entire show where I don't know why anyone is laughing. It's really hard to do. I can't think of it in Kraken. I know in Squid Boy, like feeding, there's a thing that I do where I get an invisible, imaginary packet of crisps. And I just eat crisps. And then I start, and then I like eat a bird because we know Trevi loves animal cruelty gags. And then I start sharing the crisps around with all the rest of the audience. And eating the crisps and sharing them, it's both very funny. That always gets a big laugh. And I never know why. Even you then had a little chuckle.
I was remembering seeing it. I remember the bit because you're feeding people birds and you feed... Do you? I saw this in Melbourne, rather.
Yeah.
You fed everyone crisps and then you fed... I remember eating a sheep.
I ate a sheep.
Oh,
great.
And I don't know whether you gave me a sheep or I turned into a sheep. I think you gave me a sheep.
Yeah, he gave you.
And I remember I got a big laugh. I was quite proud of myself. We didn't know each other at the time. And I got a laugh from the room because I was twisting it to get it into my mouth.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. It was really silly. But I had a funny idea. I'll kind of twist it like that and it'll look like, oh, this guy in the audience turns out is a pretty funny guy. You know, I'm still following my clever idea.
Yeah, right.
Do you know what I mean? Whereas that's very different, isn't it, to what... I remember seeing you eating the crisps and the reason I laughed then was because... And I immediately started trying to analyse it just then. It's because you're eating the crisps. It's because you don't know why it's funny. And we see in your eyes that... I think there's some curiosity or God, I really want to pin it down. It's probably impossible, but there's some sense that like you're showing off doing something rubbish. And the fact that it's nothing to show off about, but you're showing off about it, there's a little glint in your eye. Like, yeah, these are crisps. This is my great crisps bit. It's something like that is hugely lovable and silly.
Yeah, maybe. I always think it's watching someone like the pleasure of eating things. Like, it's a great, if you ever like are doing some sort of little workshop or something, like just give someone a banana and tell them just to eat and really enjoy eating a banana in front of a room, because it can be great as long as people lose their like ideas bit. Like, if you just see someone happy to eat a banana, it is the funniest thing in the world. It is so good. I think that's where it came from, like just eat the pleasure of eating. There's an open joyousness about, I'm eating crisps.
Do you have a funny self? Do you have a funny, what am I describing? What am I trying, or sort of clutching at? There's a sort of a face you do that you did just then, which is kind of like that. And it's and I'm sorry, apologies to people listening to this, you'll just need to imagine a face doing a thing, but you have a sort of a kind of, you dip your head forward slightly, you're like, like that. And that's like, that's you in funny mode. Do you know what I mean? And I've seen you do it socially, and you do it a lot on stage.
Yeah.
That's like, like there's some sense of, there we go. And I go, that's Trigby. That's why Trigby's funny. That's what your clown looks like, is that guy.
Is that guy. Mm.
Yeah.
Can I take a photo of it? Hang on, I want to take a photo of you doing
me doing it. Okay.
Of it. Okay. Yeah.
I think that's okay. What it is.
That's good. I'll try and send it to you.
Thanks, man. I know you can follow me at ComComPod if you're listening to this, and I will tweet it when this show comes out. I will try and remember to tweet it. But yeah. So, what do you recognize that you do that?
Yeah.
What
yeah,
does it mean?
I do recognize it.
What is that for you? Is it a thing you come back to? Is it a...
It is a little bit. It's kind of... And I sometimes feel like it's one of these habits that I want to get rid of because I know it works a little bit, like, in this, like, proud child grin that I like to call it.
Yeah.
Someone's like, I loved your show. Oh, thanks. And it's like, I'm a proud child.
Yes.
I'm a big, brave boy.
Yes.
Like that.
That's interesting.
And I do. I know it happens and it's cheap. I really worry.
What is it that's cheap? Why is it cheap?
That I know it works.
Because you know it works.
Yeah.
So it's not an act of discovery or creation anymore. It's you falling back on your one-liner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's good. I often feel like that is something that I've stolen from Phil, from Dr. Brown, from Carlo Giacucci as well.
I don't know Carlo. Okay.
He's good. I think Phil's stolen heaps of stuff from Carlo.
Okay.
It's just this line of theft.
Yeah.
Like, Goliath graduates. Yeah. And it's one of those things that I'm like, damn it, I'm doing... Like, there's some little things that I do on stage where I'm like, that's my Phil thing. And I'm doing it because I've seen him do it.
Do you
start copying him?
Do you need to be careful about that? I mean, we could talk about your show in the context of his. I mean, you're in the same space in the underbelly.
Yeah, it's funny. Last year, everyone, like, the reviewers for Squid Boy went, well, he's no Dr. Brown.
Yeah, okay.
And now this year, they're all like, he's just trying to be Dr. Brown.
Yeah.
What do you want, you people? It's interesting. It puts me in a funny place. I'm like, I really want to find the Trigvy Wakenshortness and, like, move away from that. But it's hard, you know? Phil, like, Dr. Brown really just opened the door to all this stuff.
Yes.
This physical
and are you,
world.
Do you feel that you exist in the wake of Dr. Brown? Because I was sort of thinking, if you got here first, if you came here 6 years ago, or I don't know, like, pick a figure, if you got here the year before he did, then maybe people would be going, oh, Dr. Brown, he's a bit Trigvy Wakenshaw.
Yeah.
Or is it that you are in kind of chronologically, you saw it and it inspired you?
I think that is probably more true.
Gotcha.
I think I think
it's very different. What you do
that.
Is very different. It's just that part of why Phil went off here to such an extent. I mean, he's brilliant, and I think you're both fantastic performers. But also, part of it was that Edinburgh didn't know what had hit it because it had never seen anyone do it before.
Yeah, yeah.
And now that that gate is open, that's one of the things you can do. No one's going to have that much impact again until they take from another. You know, display frame another existing thing in a different context.
Yeah.
I've sort of got a pet theory that if you are brilliant at something else and then you come to the world of stand-up loses its mind because you go, oh my god, you can do this,
right? Yeah
See, also being a pianist, being a freestyle rapper, being a mime, there's lots of things that you can be excellent at in other categories, and then you turn up here and there's something about the nature of Fringe or Edinburgh specifically, whatever it is, that people lose their shit and go, oh my god, this is so new and different. And everyone from the previous world of mime or piano or freestyle would kind of look at it and go, was just that thing. Do you know what I mean? which isn't to denigrate the brilliant skills involved, but there is that sort of framing thing. Mm. So do you feel that you have to steer clear of Phil-ish material? Do you ever find yourself, when we're sort of discussing that face and going, I've kind of, that's a little bit borrowed, you know?
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't have said that face in particular, but, and I don't, maybe it's a goalie exercise, I don't know, but there's a thing Phil does with his body, kind of like an impulse that comes through him, that kind of is like that, that you yeah, also have a sort of an impulse. It's like, you're on stage, you've got nothing, do something. Is, you know, that's sort of a lean forward of the chest. Some sort.
Yeah.
Yours is very, you mean, is very distinct from his, but it's like a thing rippling through you. Like,
where are we going? Yeah, I know what you mean. I do try and avoid it. I'm okay with it at the moment. I know that I get compared to Dr. Brown a lot, and it's frustrating, but I understand. And I think it's how I am going about finding out who I am as a performer. Like Squid Boy, I made hugely influenced by a guy called Julien Cottereau, he's ex-Cirque du Soleil. He had a show here last year called Imagine-toi. French mime clown guy, does lots of like real like whimsical, charming, imagination building stuff on stage, and I was hugely influenced by that for Squid Boy. And then I think then later on Squid Boy started to get influenced by Dr. Brown. Kraken is a little bit more that, and I'm trying to find myself, but you do it, you go through your influences, you're like, oh, am I like this guy? And you work out that in a way you're like that guy. And then I'm now in developing new shows, trying to find the thing that is Trygve Wakenshaw. Like I'd love, that's my dream, to get to the point where I'm like, that is purely me. That is just how I am funny on stage.
Yeah. I would never have guessed that Cottereau was in your kind of pedigree of things you were emulating. You're a million miles away from him, I think. I saw him there maybe 5 years ago or more. And something that I found frustrating in his work, he smashed it to pieces. The gig I saw him at absolutely tore it apart. But for me, I felt his stuff was beautiful set pieces.
Yeah.
And there was no... He was sweating a lot, but I don't know that he was risking a lot.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? It was like a beautiful confection.
Mm.
And what I want from a clown is sawdust and mistakes and...
Yeah,
do you know what right. I mean? Like, do you see what I mean? So,
yeah, I know.
But what aspects of his work, what specific things, I don't mean specific bits, but like what was it that appealed to you about Cottereau?
I think I liked that, the sort of refinedness of it. And mostly, the biggest thing would have just been the fact that he created this world. Like he had like a few technical things, like
he had the microphone.
And he could shift his voice as well for some of that stuff, but like everything that he did, like playing with a ball with the audience, throwing a ball into the audience, having them throw it back, there's a moment where he plays like imaginary hacky sack with he gets a kid up on stage and they just kick a ball between the two of them and he's making all the sound effects, but the kid in the audience, like everyone can see this ball.
That's definitely going true. Around. Absolutely, yeah.
And you know, in the show, he like paints like off stage. There's this great giant sleeping beast that he's sort of carefully trying to not wake up. And yeah, and like all that was so clear. Like when I was watching the show, I had such a clear picture of all these things that he was playing with. That was the thing that inspired me. I love that.
In Squid Boy, there is, it's clear what you're doing, like the mimes and the games are clear, but the narrative is very far from clear. It's much more like a sort of collage of surreal. I mean, the for those who haven't seen it, the premise was it's a squid dreaming he's a fisherman, or a fisherman dreaming he's a squid.
Yeah.
That is not, you know, that is a difficult sentence to understand, even though I've seen the show, you know. So were you, so let's just talk a bit about clarity and meaning and what you'd like an audience to understand, other than some sense of like, there's a world. Okay, we get you created a world.
Yeah.
What is it with Squid Boy that you were aiming for? What experience in the audience were you aiming for?
I was trying to see how much I could put into the audience head. Like, it's hard to not talk about it as a world. Because that was it. Like, can I create a place where there's a cow that you can see, there's a dog that you can see, we play games together, there's a tree, there's a sandwich floating on a hook. And then, yeah, and then the sort of twist at the end was to take all of that away. I think someone compared it really nicely once to, like, reading a book. Like, you read a book and it says, like, you know, he wore a yellow jacket. And in your head, suddenly, boom, there's this picture of this yellow jacket. And you know very... You can see all of this stuff happening. And I wanted to try doing that in a theatre show, I think. Like, yeah, similar to how you read a book. And all the images go, dunk de dunk dunk, without it all having to be there put in front of you.
Are you trying to create an emotional experience for the audience?
I was in that one. I didn't do it so successfully. In Squid Boy, I wanted a moment where it was funny, 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 and then you cry at the loss of the big world that we've, you know, built together. And it more or less happens. It's okay.
Okay. Why only more or less? What is it, do you think, that's because getting in the way?
It just doesn't go strong enough, you know, like the pathos at the end. I'd love it if, like, you could just, like, if I walked away and everyone was, like, weeping at the end, going, like, we love this character. I think it's because it's so, like, the show is now so much, like, just me dressed as a squid being an idiot, that we kind of love me rather than, like, you don't feel as much loss of the world or something. Or the goodbye isn't as...
And why did you want this big goodbye? Is it so that you could show off as an artist because you made people cry?
Yeah, I wanted to make a comedy show that people... I really like the idea of making people cry.
Do you work...
I'd love to do that. Maybe that'll be my next show. Just see if I can traumatise people into joyous sadness, you know.
Do you have sort of principles that you follow? Do you have rules in your head? Like a writer, I mean, one of the first times I asked this question, I think the example I used was one of the rules for writers is don't get it right, get it written. You know, like a sort of a useful analogies that you come back to when you're, not analogies, aphorisms, that you come back to when you're making or playing.
Not really. I'm a bit lazy when it comes to making, so it's just about playing on stage. I try not to apologise. That's one thing. I don't like the thing where you see... Like, if you're going to go and improvise something and risk it, then pretend, like, that was the ultimate you could do. Like, it's really shitty when you see someone go, oh, sorry. Like, when... It's my thing when stand-ups do that thing where they, like, a joke sucks and then they go... Oh, well, that's that new material isn't going into the next set. It's like, shut up, you wrote the joke. Deal with it. Live with that joke. Sit, brood in it. Don't apologise for it and sweep it under a rug. Feel bad for your shitty, shitty joke.
Yeah. No, that is classic Goliath there. Yeah. Experience the pain.
Experience
own
it.
Own the pain that you just told an awful joke.
Don't apologise for it. So I try not to apologise. That's one thing. None of this is 100% always working either. But that, at the moment, I'm really interested in, like, sort of transition. Okay, this isn't a rule, it's just a thing I'm interested in, and trying to get rid of story and having structure based on something else.
How do you mean? I didn't know, I'm interested in that. What do you mean?
So
I'm interested in that. What are you talking about?
Squid Boy, I tried to make, like, with this little story about who is dreaming. Is it a fisherman or is it a squid? Da, da, da. And then nonsense happens in between. And then Kraken, I tried to have it so everything would flow into the next thing. So it was stream of consciousness I'm trying to explore further. I think maybe it's just because I'm really bad at writing endings for things. So as long as there's, like, the scene has some funny material in it, if you go from the end of that and waft into something else that begins new, then you don't have to write an ending. Whoa, yeah, it's because I'm bad at writing endings.
Do you create anything off stage? Do you have an idea for a bit and then go on stage and play it? Do you do any work before you go on stage and play it?
I haven't recently. I will go on stage going like, ah, I think there's a scene about a boxer. And then I'll go on stage and just go, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, sometimes scene titles. Like, that. Like you can just go like, oh, I need, there's 5 minutes, it's not quite right. Okay, I'll try and do a scene called The Sunshine and the Flowers. And then I have that stupid picture in my head and go like, okay, I now perform The Sunshine and the Flowers and make it up from a stupid scene title. I don't, at the moment with my solo stuff, I haven't been working on things in a rehearsal room. I tried really hard, but I find it impossible. Like, there's no one to bounce ideas off, and I start second-guessing whether anything's funny at all. And nothing really works until you put it in front of an audience. But I think for future stuff, I'd like to go back to trying to write a bit more. Like, Kraken came from pretty much entirely on-stage things. Like, the nudity moment at the start was an idea. Everything else was just improvised.
And do you, once you play, if you have an idea for The Sunshine and the Flowers, and mm-hmm. you go on stage and you play it in front of an audience,
yeah.
Do you come off and take notes afterwards? Do you sort of reflect on it and go, maybe next time if I did that? Or is it, you're on, that's happening now, it's worth going back to or not, and you don't think about it till the next time you do it?
I'll think about it, not in a formal way, though. Like, I don't go back and, like, have a little notebook and go, things that were good about the show.
Sure.
I use, like, a technician or someone, whoever's doing the lights tends to be the person that I ask to write down any thoughts. I let it be their thoughts. I don't like to think about it too much myself.
Do you dance around your bedroom practicing mimes? There's the equivalent of, do you stand with a hairbrush in your hand practicing your material?
I sort of do.
Do you really? I was worried that was a stupid question.
No, I do a little bit. I know I can get quite hypnotized by my own face trying to, like, move different muscles, going like, how does that one work? Like, looking in a mirror, just, like, bending my face into strange shapes. I quite enjoy that. And different muscles on my body, I try and... Yeah, so I love being in, like, dance studios, where they have, like, just a big wall of mirrors. I can never come up with any scenes, but I love looking at my body going in weird shapes. Like, does that go over there? Oh, it does, wow. Okay. That looks weird.
Yeah. What do you do with your body? Were you ever a dancer or anything like that?
No, I wish I was.
Are you trained in anything, or are you just a big lanky twat that kind of...
Yeah, and that one. I'm option B. I would love to do some actual dance training. But I don't... Yeah. I'd love to do, like, an intensive... I was considering going off to dance school, like, maybe next year or something, but I don't think I'm actually going to do that.
I wanted to ask you about your costume and how you found it, how you came up with that. Is that, like, that's the question. How did you find that costume?
Kraken costume.
Which is sort of a leotard and a headband and wristbands.
Yeah. It came from an idea when I was thinking about the show. That's right. I had this idea. I'd been thinking about costume. Costume's pretty important for me, for starting point. Going like, okay, I don't feel like just normal street Trigvi. Like, I could never perform in what I'm wearing now, which is, like, black skinny jeans and a hoodie. Like, I couldn't do that. So I need a costume to be like, I'm performer Trigvi now. And it came from an idea of a swimmer. Oh, because the show was called Kraken, which is, like, the great mythical sea monster. Which it turns out not everyone knows.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
People are like, what is a Kraken? Like, it's a big squid-like sea monster. Ooh. It sinks ships and stuff. Not everyone knows that.
Okay. It's a sort of mythological... Really, it's like Greek mythology, isn't it?
Yeah. Norse.
Norse. Is
yeah.
it really?
Yeah.
Is it from Norse?
Yeah, it's Norse.
Ah, there was me thinking, oh, I'm cleverer than most people because I know what a Kraken is. I didn't realise it was Norse. Yeah. I like it even more now.
Yeah. So,
Swimmer.
What were you saying?
Swimming culture.
I was like thinking around water type things, and I wanted a swimming costume. And the idea, my great idea, was that I was going to wear like little swimming shorts, shave my body entirely, wear this weird orange fake tan, and cover myself in baby oil because I thought it would be shiny and look funny, and on stage, and. At like this like kind of weird rubber swimming cap that I found in Norway. And that was the original idea. And I held on to this idea for a long time because I didn't have many ideas for the show. So any ideas were very precious. And then one day I decided, well, I should probably test this idea out before I commit to it. So I got a small group of people into a room to go, I've got this idea. I've got a couple of ideas. I want to show you a few things. And at some point I just started pouring baby oil all over myself and rubbing it into my body. And everyone that was in this room just looked at me silently and felt weird. And then I felt weird. And it was the worst. It was the worst idea I've ever had. So that idea went out the window. But
it's a shame because it would be so convenient to do every night. So it's a shame that's not funny.
I know, covered in baby oil and fake tan. I think it just changed from that. Oh, I know also where it came from. It was a little bit in Perth. I did a couple of street performance things.
Okay.
And so just tried to be a little bit classical mime in a sort of cheap clothing kind of a way.
Okay, were you getting an edge? Were you getting, like, what was the circumstance of your doing street stuff? Were you booked into a slot and mucking around, or were you just in the street?
Yeah, I was booked into a slot and mucking around. Okay. There was a guy that had been performing there. He was leaving, and the guys that were running this venue that had the spot that he was on went, hey, do you want to come and do some stuff?
Okay.
I was like, yes, of course. having never done street stuff before.
How did you find it?
It was good. I mean, it was a really nice atmosphere. So I didn't... Like, it was within a sort of...
Festival kind of
garden area. So it was a little bit... Like, the crowd understood. Like, I could never do that stuff in, like, a... Just on the street anywhere.
Okay.
But, it was okay. So that came from that. The rest of the costume just sort of... It slowly just evolved. From the tights. I liked wearing dance shoes, so I got a pair of dance shoes. The top used to be beige, except because I sweat so much. During the show, this beige kind of tan top would just get these little puddly patches of sweat marks all over it. So we had to go for black, just because it's not very, so obvious.
Very wise. I'm wondering how much of your mime, how much of your performance comes from imagination and how much of it from observation. Like, I remember doing sort of clown course type exercises where you study what butter looks like when you fry it and then you try and mimic quality. Have you done anything like that, or is it all just purely crazy stuff coming out of your head?
It's all just imagination world. I've never done any researchy parts, but I should. I find myself... It's really interesting doing the two shows back-to-back at the same time because I can see all the crossover of ideas that I've stolen from myself and repeated from myself. And now I'm being a bit more like, actually, I need to do a bit of homework and practice and just, like, build up a little bit of extra stuff in the old mental bookshelf.
And thank you. That's interesting. I sort of assumed that might be the case.
Yeah.
I
need to read more. Reading always does good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What kind of thing?
Don't know. Just anything. Books. I need to read more books.
Reading. What kind of thing? Oh, I like books. Oh, no. Not so much magazines. And does anyone come in and direct the show ever? Do you ever ask friends to have like an outside eye on it who then suggest, oh, that character could come back at that point? Or is it all flowing from you and the audience?
It's all from me. I've tried working with other people earlier on, but it's too hard to do. The shows are now very much mine, and I don't like to give up that bit of responsibility. Not for these shows. I like working with other people, but these shows is too hard to go to share that, because it's my dream and my imagination and my world, and it all links together in my own brain in a special kind of way. And someone else, what, like, aside from going, that bit works, that bit doesn't work, like, that's as much direction as I can get, really, and I get that from an audience.
And do you, I mean, I've only seen you be great. Presumably you have bad gigs sometimes.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to wade through an hour to people that just no one was going for it, or does that never happen to you?
I don't remember that happening. My worst times are when it's like personally bad for me, where I am wading through an hour, like nothing is sparking, I'm not having any fun, I can't get the vibe of the audience.
Are they still laughing?
Yeah.
But you're not satisfied with the quality of it?
Yeah, they're laughing. They're not laughing as well as a, like, killer show. But, yeah, I've never had a totally cold, cold audience. Nearly. It sometimes nearly happens, but then you can usually it's like at doing a 10-minute slot, because people aren't there expecting to see you. So they're just like, what is this idiot doing leaping around the stage?
And how do you cope with that?
At the time
and afterwards? Are you kind of, you seem well adjusted enough that you'd shrug it off?
Yeah. Well, usually I can, it's like the game with the one man out of the whole crowd, I will just focus on that one man. So usually I'll do that. Like, if I can make one guy laugh, then
that, I would love to apply that to stand up. If I'm having a tough gig, to find the person who's enjoying it the least and direct it all to them. But the problem is that I can't see that working for stand up because it's so cerebral and kind of wit based, and it's clear. It's just the opposite of that clowning stuff. And, you know, Phil used to say in the classes, "Forget about, we don't care about your clever idea." Mm. And I sort of, as a stand up, you kind of go, "That's all I've got is my clever idea."
Mm.
So to try and win someone over with logic, you know, and that's not what you're doing, is it? It's totally
winning them over with charm. You just have to be charming. You can do whatever you want. You can tell them jokes, or I don't know, push a wheelie chair around the stage. But you're just looking at this one person, and with your eyes going, "I'm doing this for you, buddy." You know why? Because I love you.
Do you think that they know that? What experience do you think they have when you're thinking, "I'm doing this for you"? Do they think this guy's doing it for me, or do they think, is this idiot to get off my case, or what?
Yeah,
what do you imagine?
Really, they get a little special smile. I'm not sure what their thought process is, but you can see that great moment when they break, when they're like, no, stop it, don't look at me. Oh, this guy.
Oh, that's lovely. Finally, do you worry at all that this type of work, given what we were saying before about suddenly there's you and Phil, mm-hmm. and there's more on the way, do you have a concern that this material will be seen as faddish? It's sort of in vogue at the moment.
Yeah.
It's very hard to imagine shows like yours existing here 10 or 15 years ago.
Mm.
Is it hard to imagine them now that they're continuing? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's probably a fad, a little bit. Hopefully it inspires a whole bunch of people. Like, you know, I was inspired by something so to make all this happen. I think comedy generally, like, has quite a short half-life. Like, sketch is very out at the moment, is that right? I don't know, I don't really follow.
Difficult to say. There's so much of everything now, it's hard to kind of go. I mean, you can certainly look at the awards and go what they seem to have been excited about, and not that I would use the awards necessarily as a barometer for anything other than the opinions of 10 people or however many people it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very, that's that thing of, oh, we're observing the festival, we've made these decisions, and then everyone goes, oh, that's what the festival is now, which I don't think is the case at all. But people like John Kearns and Liam Williams, they seem to be, there is like, and Ben Targe to a certain extent as well, people who are kind of inventing something rather than, there's like a lot of conventional, inverted commas, conventional stand-up here. Mm. And I love conventional stand-up, and I personally want to get very good as I possibly can at the conventional thing.
Yeah.
That is not in vogue at the moment, because I think people have had a bit of a backlash against this. So much of it about this, so much of it being successful on telly, that people is like, you know, I feel like it's like if you can make a really good bow, like a bow and arrow bow, you know, the exact technique to get the string just right and it's that perfect thing. I feel like at the moment everyone's going, there's loads of bows. He just makes bows. You know, want a guy that can make a ball and chain. And you're like, but I don't want to make a ball and chain. I'm really, the tension of the string and the finding the right wood and the flex and all the rest, that's my thing. So I think at the moment there's a lot of people going, oh no, we're making, I was going to say like mustard gas, but not because I'm suggesting there's anything evil about the work of anyone, but you know what I mean? It's like a whole different set of things.
New weapons.
This is a very complicated analogy.
I know what you mean.
But, just whether or not you think it goes in waves, and if it does go in waves, then do you have another plan for what you might do if it becomes less... If suddenly, if you're here in 5 years' time and there's 100 clowny, worldly engineer shows, do you have plans for what you might do instead, or where else it could go next, or what you would like to pursue next?
Yeah, I'm really scared of becoming, like... kind of like boy with tape on his face, like, you know what that show is. Like, I'd rather be a guy who makes a bit, like, next year I'd really love to try something quite different, but I'm very scared of doing that. Like, I'm really scared to go, like, okay, where else does this comedy thing lie? People expect me to be this, like, physical comedian, and I love doing it as well. So I don't know. I am scared that I'll get stuck in this little wave of popularity of popular physical comedy stuff that's happening at the moment. But I don't know. I don't really think about it too much. I don't know. I don't really have an opinion on where I stand in comedy, because I feel like I try and be a bit foot inside theatre as well. I don't know. I don't feel I'm so deeply immersed in it that it's going to affect me deeply. it's a really tough question. I want to be the guy that makes us something new. I want to try and, I don't know, like, explore myself, like, what it is that is Trigvi Wakenshaw funny. And then go, there you go, everyone. And like what Dr. Brown did, or like what Kim Noble is doing. Like, I went and saw his show last night. It's amazing. It's really good. I don't know. There's a lot I don't know, and I can't answer your question. And you're just looking at me silently, and I'm digging myself into a hole.
You're not digging yourself into a hole at all. I was interested to see where that thought was going, because you got a very far away look in your eyes. You were sort of looking into the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And I was interested to see. I was also, let the record clearly state, I was smiling at you, because I wasn't staring at you.
No, you were smiling at me. It wasn't me.
I don't want to go on Stu's podcast, he just stares at you. This is Stu's new thing, being quiet. What advice would you give to young Trigvi Wakenshaw?
Oh, whoa. Young Trigvi Wakenshaw. I don't know. He's done pretty well. I don't think he needs advice. Anything I tell him is going to be ridiculous. A piece of advice, though. I don't know if Trigvi needs it, because he's okay. He falls for it sometimes.
He's going to be okay. So Trigvi, the guy who's kind of looking in at Trigvi, enjoying himself and thinking, I want to do this. What advice have you got for him?
It's a little bit around the doing things, which is just don't be so cynical about other comedians, I think, and like what other shows, like especially bad shows. Go and see bad shows, and I really like all that stuff. Like, you know how there are those people that sometimes that are just really negative and critical of everyone else's work? And I think it's a bad way to be, because you're not... You may, like, these people, whoever it is, even if they've made a terrible, terrible show, they made it. They sat in a room, probably, and wrote down this, like, stupid ideas, and they did it badly, and it was awful, and it was a waste of your hour. But they they did it. And then you have to, like, appreciate them for that. You can go, like, it's a terrible show, but you have to love that people are making just stuff. Volume. Just make heaps more comedy, everyone.
Thanks, man.
So that was Trigvi. Thank you very much to him for coming on the show. Hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Thank you to Ben Lund Conlon for this week's Podmin. Thanks, Ben. And thank you also to Nathan Wood, who co-produced this week's episode. Back next week with David Cross. Look forward to that. I'll speak to you then. And remember, if you would like to donate, you can do that at comedianscomedian.com. All your donations gratefully received. And if you don't fancy donating, then please feel free to share the show with a friend, point them at the YouTube channel or at any of these episodes on SoundCloud or on iTunes. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.